Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast, Jamie and John back together again. What's up, buddy?
Dude, it feels so good to be back, and you sound great. I feel like you're getting better. You're not going to die on me.
Not 100%. This flu business is no joke. It had me down about as bad as I've been down, but I'm getting there.
It feels so weird because usually this time of year, I'm the one who's down for like a month or more. Yeah. So I don't know what happened. We got our roles reversed, but I'm glad to be on this side of the desk.
I was going
to
say, you can have it back. I'll tell you that much.
I feel like it's a time bomb. I'm just waiting. Sure. And I'll get it eventually because everyone else around us has it. So
yeah. Yeah. Canceling schools and everything. We hope our listeners are healthy wherever you are. I know there's a ton of stuff going around with kids going back to school and that kind of thing. But we're very appreciative that you're here with us. And we have a phenomenal, phenomenal case today, in my opinion.
We absolutely do. Before we get started with that, I do have a couple of folks I would like to say thank you to. They are joining us on Patreon. First, we have Carrie, who joined us last week with the $30 a year. So the $3 level. Took advantage of a discount and got a whole year's worth of bonus episodes for $30. And then we also have Wesley, who did the same thing. So Carrie and Wesley, thank you so much. And for others, if you're thinking about joining Patreon, go ahead and subscribe. $3 a month is going to get you a bonus episode each and every month and early ad-free content as well.
And other bonus things that we randomly come across and get to throw in. So it's a good time. It keeps our lights on, and we're very appreciative to all those over there. But let me just start with saying that I'm a pretty big consumer of true crime. I'm always looking for new stuff to listen to. This is a case that wasn't really on my radar till a few months ago, and I've changed my mind about it multiple times. So I'm curious to see. I know it's a little bit fresher for you, John, and some of our listeners. This may be their first time hearing about it. So I'm just fascinated to see other people's takes on it. So why don't you get us rolling?
Today we are going to bring you a case that left investigators, a courtroom, and an entire community searching for answers. We're going to be talking about the Vaughn family murders. And we're going to ask, was this a cold, calculated act of a father seeking freedom? Or was this a tragic murder-suicide involving a mother pushed to her breaking point? Either way you go, you're left with a devastating, tragic case, right? But our story will begin on a warm summer morning in June of 2007. Oh man, that feels like it's not been that long ago, but also an eternity away at the same time. Does that make sense?
It has,
like,
yes.
A lot has changed in my life since then, and certainly in the lives of those we're going to be talking about today. But on a warm summer day, June 2007, the quiet town of Shanahan, Illinois, a father named Christopher Vaughn limps down a desolate frontage road. He's bleeding from minor injuries, but nearby, his SUV is parked on the side of the road with his wife and three children inside. So that was it was first thought to be a tragic accident, but soon revealed itself to be something far more sinister.
And there are a lot of rabbit holes that go down here, and we'll chase some of those and talking about the Vaughn family, what happened leading up to that morning, and then the events that unfolded afterwards. But basically, what we're left with here is that Chris Vaughn is going to be accused of murdering his entire family and then limping away from the car to be discovered. So to fully understand the gravity of what's happening, let's go back to who the Vaughns are. Now, Chris Vaughn was a private investigator and IT professional, but he was completely self-taught and self-made. He didn't go to college for this. He basically learned how to do cybersecurity before cybersecurity was cool, went to major companies and pitched his services and made a great living out of it. It's really impressive what he did professionally. Friends described him as intelligent, somewhat reserved, but deeply interested in the outdoors. He was interested in survivalism, and he was a man with big dreams. He eventually, even though he was a big family man at the time of this, wanted to move out to the Yukon and spend the rest of his life living in the woods.
Christopher's wife's name was Kimberly, and she was a stay-at-home mom. She was a dedicated mother to their three children, who were 12-year-old Abigail, 11-year-old Cassandra, and 8-year-old Blake. Kimberly was well-loved by those who knew her, but she was struggling with some significant health challenges. She suffered from migraines and anxiety, and she was prescribed some medications to help with those. She was prescribed Topamax, nortriptyline. Nortriptyline is used for anxiety, and it reportedly helped out, but had some serious side effects. The Vaughns had moved to Illinois a few years earlier, looking for a fresh start, and by all accounts, they appeared to be your typical suburban family. Christopher worked long hours in order to provide for his family, and Kimberly, like I said earlier, she's a stay-at-home mom. She was focused on raising her children. But behind the scenes, things were not as perfect as they seemed if you were to be looking in on this family.
Yeah, if you ask people close to the family, it seems like Kimberly's health issues were putting a strain on the marriage. Friends would later say that Chris seemed a little distant and frustrated, like he was carrying a heavy burden by being the provider, but also having to care. And, you know, you sign up for marriage for better or for worse. And I think in most marriages, it goes back and forth through these types of times, but they were having a tough time leading up to this event. She was stressed. She was overworked. She had these medical problems. She's raising three kids, and she was trying to go to school to be able to join Chris's business and do the same type of work that he was doing. So by June of 2007, the family dynamic was really reaching a breaking point. Chris had become really vocal about his desire to not have to deal with the pressures of what was going on at home. And this is, again, according to close friends. To some, he talked about starting over, abandoning his family perhaps, and going and living out in the middle of the woods by himself. But is this something that he was just saying inventing? Was this something that he was wanting to do on his own? And if he did want to leave his family, does that mean up and leave, or does that mean leave them dead behind him?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's going to be kind of the focus of the story as it unfolds. But this brings us to the morning of June 14th, 2007. So Christopher and Kimberly had planned on the family trip. They wanted to go to Springfield, Illinois to visit a water park. And for the Vaughn children, it was supposed to be a day of fun, family bonding. I mean, shoot, anytime I used to take our kids to the water park in the summertime, and they just were so excited to go. So I can imagine the anticipation they had. For Kimberly, it was a chance for her to escape the routine of daily life. These kids are young, but they're old enough to take care of themselves at a water park.
Right.
And you can just, as a parent, you're there, you're supervising, but you're not keeping a child alive. It's not like taking a toddler to a water park. So
right.
Kimberly was hoping to just unwind, let the kids play. And I get it. I love going to the pool when my kids were this age, because it's just a time for me to sit there and do nothing. And I loved it.
It's a great time as a parent when you're transitioning from that completely hands-on to being able to take a little time to sit back and watch.
But for Christopher, it may have been something entirely different. So according to his testimony later on, the morning started early. The family piled into their Ford Expedition. Kimberly was in the passenger seat. Of course, the kids were in the back. The trip began normally enough, but it was early. It was right after 5 a.m. Christopher claimed that Kimberly said she was not feeling very well. So this is a pretty early trip to the water park.
It is, and they did have to drive kind of far, and we'll get into some other alleged plans they have here in a bit. But I don't know. I know a lot of families that would rather get up and leave at 5 a.m. and arrive somewhere when it opens than get there in the middle of the day. So I know these people, right? So when Kimberly said she wasn't feeling well, he pulled over so that she could have some room to get out if she needed to vomit, if she needed to get some air. And they pulled out into this, again, a kind of a frontage road off I-55. And everything from this point remains a point of intense debate. Christopher told investigators that Kimberly became agitated, saying that she needed air and that she was feeling sick. But then when they stopped, he said that she allegedly retrieved a 9mm pistol from under the seat, a gun that belonged to Chris. He was an avid gun owner, and she turned it on him. He claimed that she shot him in the wrist and the leg, and he did have gunshot wounds to the wrist and the leg. He got out to try to save himself as he was being shot, and then she turned the gun on her own children and killed them before ultimately he assumed killing herself.
This is a freaking nightmare. You know, whether it was her or him, we do know that the children are at this point dead.
Right.
So Christopher, like you said, he said that he fled the vehicle in a panic. And as he stumbled away, he was, of course, injured and bleeding. But as he was stumbling away, he heard more gunshots behind him. And he said that when he looked back, it was too late. So she had turned to the gun on herself, according to Christopher. So this was just after 5:30 a.m. And a passing motorist spotted Christopher limping along the road. And he was able to flag this driver down. And soon after that, first responders arrived at the scene. And man, we talk about this all the time, but you hear the call come out. I'm sure there's no way in the world you can prepare yourself for what you're about to see, to pull up onto this SUV and see this scene, three children dead, and then the mom laying nearby also.
When deceased. I get ready for work every day, sometimes I'll picture like, well, I hope this thing doesn't happen or that thing doesn't happen. And those things never include blood and dead people. So God bless these people doing this work. But that day was a bad day for them for sure. And what they found inside was exactly what you would expect. It was horrifying. Kimberly was slumped over in the passenger seat. She had a gunshot wound to the head. In the back seat, the bodies of Abigail, Cassandra, and Blake were discovered. And each child had been shot twice at close range with the 9mm that was found laying in Kimberly's lap. Now, this led some people to initially suspect that this was a murder-suicide, that she had shot her husband, her kids, turned the weapon on herself, and then the gun fell into her lap. But as the investigators dug deeper, they didn't really buy this theory, and they thought the evidence started to tell a different story, one that pointed to Chris Vaughn as the suspect of the violence that occurred in their car that morning.
What struck investigators almost immediately was his demeanor. So he was physically injured, but he had no like emotional response. Didn't seem like he had any, like he wasn't panicked. He wasn't like crying. I don't know what I would be if this actually happened, but he was noticeably calm, cool, and collected.
Now here's the thing. We talk about this all the time in 911 calls. Like he may be in shock. So I am in no way discounting his, I don't buy into the fact that because he was chill or because he wasn't going crazy that he did something. I don't think that should be used as evidence. But
I don't know that I would ever count this as evidence, but it did strike investigators who happened to be on the scene early. And he seemed almost detached and was able to recount his version of events very calmly. He claimed that he had no idea why Kimberly snapped. He suggested that perhaps her medications might have caused her to have erratic behavior. And he insisted that she must have killed the children before turning the gun on herself.
But there were inconsistencies in Chris's story. One that's a continued point of contention is the trajectory of the gunshot wounds. So depending on who you ask, and there are people who adamantly defend Chris here and say that it does appear like the bullets came from someone sitting in the passenger side, but authorities, when they looked at it, felt like it didn't look that way at all. According to them, it appeared as though Chris had shot his wife, turned the weapon on his kids before shooting himself in self-inflicted, intentionally minor injuries. John, if obviously I can't get into the head of somebody who's, if he did execute his family in this way, but if I decide to shoot myself, I feel like there are enough veins and arteries in my thigh to where I'm going to avoid that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so foreign of an idea.
And he's a survival guy.
Yeah, so there you go.
Investigators also noticed that his clothes showed no signs of blood spatter that would be expected if Kimberly had fired the gun from a distance at him. Instead, the evidence they believed pointed to somebody in the driver's seat holding the weapon and executing everybody else.
Within hours, the focus shifted from Kimberly to Christopher. Police were able to begin to piece together a new theory, and that was that Chris Vaughn had staged the scene to make it look like a murder-suicide, all while covering up his own role in the killings. So as they got deeper into Christopher's background, they started to see some troubling behavior from him in the days and weeks leading up to this. In particular, some emails and online searches which suggested that he had been fantasizing about leaving his family behind and starting a new life in the Yukon wilderness. He'd even researched how to survive off the grid. This included topics like fake identities and self-sufficient living. And if you're an investigator looking in on this, it seemed like he was painting a picture of a man who was desperate to escape his responsibilities and desperate enough to commit the unthinkable.
But was the evidence showing that this was done by Chris showing that he had been planning this all along, or is this simply coincidence that he had been searching for ways to get off the grid? For now, let's take a deeper dive into what Chris said happened. Now, there came a time, John, and he had several different stories. Again, he's likely in shock. He had been shot. His entire family's dead. Even if he did it, there's an element of shock that goes into this, and he would eventually cling to the fact that he said he had no memory of the actual shootings. His final story was that Kimberly asked him to pull over because she wasn't feeling well, that he got out of the SUV to check on a tire, and when he came to get back into the car, he noticed himself bleeding, and that's when he took off for help. And he says that that's all that he remembers. And he even becomes adamant saying that, I don't remember what happened, but I know that Kimberly would never hurt her kids, which if you're trying to put the blame on her is a very odd thing to say.
Yeah, but investigators were not convinced. So here's where there is some solid evidence that we can look at that's not circumstantial. So bloodstain experts were called in, and they noticed some things with the patterns. They noticed several inconsistencies in the story. One major red flag to them was a transfer stain on the back of Christopher's jacket, which suggested that he was seated in the driver's seat while blood was actively flowing from Kimberly's fatal wound. And that did not align with the idea that she shot him while he was outside of the vehicle. So basically they looked at the scene and said, this is her blood on you. Could not have got that from being outside the vehicle. That makes sense to me. And there was also the matter of Christopher's injuries. Forensic experts examined this, and they determined that the gunshot wounds to his left wrist and leg were consistent with close-range, self-inflicted gunshot wounds. And then there was the gun itself. It was found on the floorboard near Kimberly's feet, but they said that the positioning of the shell casing did not match the report that he gave, saying that this was, they said they looked at it and said, this is not possible. This did not happen in the murder-suicide theory.
And keep in mind, we said earlier that the gun was on her lap and now it's at her feet. And we said both things because both things are in various reports. And that's what gets murky here, is even within the authorities, clarity on what happened at the scene is just not present at all times. When we get back from the break, we'll dive into Kimberly's mental health history, try to figure out exactly what was going on in their marriage and if it had any role in what actually happened that day. Thank you. in an effort to be transparent and to try to follow up with Chris's claims that Kimberly was in a bad spot, they did look into her background. She was on Topamax and Nortriptyline for migraines, both of which are known to cause mood changes in rare cases. Kimberly had also mentioned experiencing some big personality changes in an email that she had sent to Christopher a few weeks before this incident. And it's important to note that there's no documented evidence of Kimberly having suicidal ideations, suicidal plans, or suicidal tendencies, or ever intending to physically harm her children. Now, if you talk to Chris's family, she was a very strict mother, and her discipline bordered on abuse, but we don't know that she wanted to intentionally hurt them. She was stressed out around this time, but nobody said, yeah, we think she's going to hurt herself and her kids. Although, again, those medications are questionable for patients in certain situations as far as creating unpredicted outcomes.
Even if things were perfect, as perfect could be at home, being a mom, stay-at-home mom to three kids, that's going to stress anybody out. And then you lay in, you know, problems with their marriage. Chris is, I mean, if all this is true, he seems like he's probably distant because he is on record for not wanting to be there anymore, right?
So right.
Probably not the most supportive, loving husband you can have. Meanwhile, investigators really zeroed in on his behavior. And I know we've talked about this is circumstantial, but they felt like it was important. His demeanor during police interrogations was described as flat and emotionless. And to them, it came across as suspicious and as if he was trying to mask his guilt. But his defense team would later argue that that was really just his personality. He wasn't a man prone to outward displays of emotions. Even in a crisis, he seemed like that was his personality. He was quirky and awkward. It's a classic example of how perception can play a big role in these cases.
Now, let's talk about one of the bigger controversies surrounding the actual investigation, and that is one that we get into often on this show in cases, especially when it's a domestic violent nature or just non-stranger crimes, is tunnel vision. From the beginning, it seemed pretty clear that police were laser focused on Christopher as the primary suspect, which he's the husband and he's the last person to see Kimberly alive, as well as the kids. That makes him suspect number one. And you can't blame them for identifying him as such. But did they look too closely? Is it not be able to look for some other things? And there are critics that say that they dismissed other evidence that might have supported a potential murder-suicide by Kimberly. For example, there's one forensic pathologist that noted that Kimberly's wound itself, she was shot under the chin, was consistent with self-infliction. While police believe that Christopher was lying about what happened, the defense would later question whether the investigation ignored these alternative explanations in order to build their case against Chris. So there are experts that testified at trial and that came forward that said, you know what, this looks like Kimberly may have been the shooter. So there's certainly room for debate in the evidence.
This is, you know, I think any case that has a murder in it is going to be challenging and tough. But if you can just kind of pause and take a step back and put yourself in the detective's shoes, you've got to get this right. Because if it was Kimberly, you do not want to put this guy who has lost literally everything in prison for something he didn't do. Also, if it was not Kimberly, then you have to put the person who did this behind bars for the rest of their life. And you've only got one shot to get it right. So this had to be a lot of pressure on the lead investigator on this.
Absolutely.
Another major point of contention was the narrative that Christopher wanted to escape his life and live alone by himself in the Canadian wilderness. Prosecutors argued that he saw his family as an obstacle and that he did all this so that he could be on his own and start over new and be out there in the desolate. But his defense team pushed back really hard. They said there was no concrete evidence to support that claim. It is worth mentioning that the arrest went down on the morning of the family's funeral. So on the morning that this was all supposed to happen, Christopher Vaughn was taken into custody and charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder. And the timing, man, you talk about, I mean, if he was guilty, then the timing was right, in my opinion.
They showed up at the funeral home.
Yeah, this whole story sucks.
Yes, you know? Amen, yeah.
But
you have to think that that's calculated by authorities, right? There were already dozens of people there. This was a media frenzy when they arrested him at the funeral home. And in my mind, I'm also thinking about his extended family, his parents who lost their grandkids, his siblings who lost their nieces and nephews. There are other people there mourning, and them for their mourning to be interrupted for this arrest. I don't know. I'm not a fan of how this went down, but maybe it's just me. The public and the press were captivated by this story, and there were different media outlets that took different sides. On one hand, the prosecution was painting Christopher as a master manipulator and a careful planner who executed his family. And on the other hand, the defense was insisting that this was a grieving husband who was caught in the middle of a huge misunderstanding. At trial, the prosecution wasted no time in setting the tone. They painted Christopher as a guy who wanted out, even if it meant murdering everyone close to him. Their narrative was really poignant. Vaughn planned the murders so that he could leave his suburban life behind and pursue a solitary existence in the wilderness of Canada, and he has talked about wanting to live in the wilderness. At the same time, he has built his company on technology. So is he going to abandon his company without selling, without taking care of his parents? There's so many questions happening here.
And to support this theory, the prosecution introduced a series of emails and other communication between Christopher and Kimberly into evidence. So these included references to marital issues they were having, Kimberly's health struggles, and then Vaughn's apparent desire for a simple, independent life in the wilderness. They argued that Vaughn saw his family as an obstacle to get to that final goal. One of the most damning pieces of evidence was Vaughn's behaviors in the days leading up to the murders. Prosecutors pointed a receipt showing that he had visited a shooting range and also purchased ammunition just right before these killings. And they claimed that this was clear evidence of premeditation.
At the same time, I get the messiness of this, right? Like, he's an outdoorsman. How many times in the last 6 months had he been shooting? I'm sure the defense tried to counter with that, but the prosecution was able to get that through. Was this out of his nature? Who knows? They said that he was cold and emotionless during those early interrogations. Prosecutors suggested his lack of grief was a sign of his guilt. The defense team, however, said not at all. They argued that he was innocent. He was in shock that his wife would do this. She had been suffering from mental health issues, depression, possible side effects of medications. They even cited an incident during early interrogation where authorities told Chris, "We have video of you doing this." And he said, "Oh, there's video of what happened. Please show me video so I can see what happened." Of course, they're bluffing about the video, but the defense would say, is a guilty person going to ask for this video? But the prosecution would say, a guilty person knows there's really no video. So it's basically leaving the jury and having served on a few, not served. I was never picked on a jury, but going through jury selection a few times, a lot of the instructions revolve around deciding who to believe, which is not very scientific, John.
So they even brought in experts to testify about the potential side effects of Topamax and nortriptyline. And those were the two medications that she was prescribed. And they argued that these drugs could definitely cause mood swings, suicidal ideation, and even in rare cases, violent behavior. The defense also highlighted Kimberly's alleged erratic behavior in the months leading up to the murders. They pointed to emails in which she described feeling like she wasn't herself. She even referenced having, quote, a big personality change, end quote. So they argued that this was consistent with someone who might have been struggling with the unintended side effects of the medications or even some other untreated mental health issues.
One of the most controversial aspects was the forensic evidence. Bloodstain pattern analysis became a very key point between the prosecution and defense. Prosecutors relied heavily on an expert that suggested that Vaughn's injuries were consistent with self-infliction and the blood patterns didn't match his version of events. For example, the prosecution said that the transfer stain, again on the back of his jacket, you mentioned it earlier, that indicated that he was in the driver's seat when Kimberly was shot, and that's the only way that her blood could have gotten on his jacket in that way, meaning that when she was shot, he had to be in the vehicle. So to me, that's a pretty damning piece of evidence, but the defense had some points too.
The defense challenged the reliability of this analysis. They argued that bloodstain patterns and their interpretations are really not an exact science, and that the evidence was open to multiple interpretations. They also questioned whether investigators had fully explored alternative explanations for the crime scene. I'm just going to pause for a minute, man. Like, there are so many, like in a scientific experiment, you're familiar with a variable, I'm sure. Like,
yep.
There are so many variables to this kind of work that is it even mathematically possible to make sure that you've covered every possible scenario to definitively say his blood stains that he had were impossible, because they're mathematically, that has to be a lot of variables.
Yeah, I don't think you can. I think you can eliminate some scenarios and say, well, because of this piece of physics, it couldn't have happened this way. Or because of the timing of this, it couldn't have happened that way. But there's still so many options.
But on the same hand, if he's alleging that he was out of the vehicle, then it would also say that it's impossible for you to have that kind of bloodstain if you were outside of the vehicle at this time. You're lying. So it's fascinating to me, I think. But one of the most dramatic moments of the trial came when prosecutors played Vaughn's taped interviews with the police. And in these recordings, as we have talked about, he appeared detached and unemotional as he described the events of that morning. I don't know how I would react to if legitimately he saw this and I saw this as him. I don't know how I would describe this to police. I don't know what kind of state I would be in. I hope I never have to find out, but my God, same. I don't think I would be cool, calm, and collected.
I know I wouldn't be that.
I would probably be extremely angry.
Blubbering, sobbing.
Crying, mad, like sad and mad all at the same time.
All the things.
Prosecutors used this to reinforce their narrative that he lacked remorse and was trying to distance himself from the crime.
The defense countered by saying that Vaughn's calm demeanor was simply his personality, and that was backed up by others. He was just a very relaxed, laid-back individual. He's very analytical and liked to think things out and really didn't express his emotions like a lot of other people would expect. Another critical aspect of the trial was the question of motive. Prosecutors presented that Vaughn had actually been researching these survival techniques of outside, and they argued that he was preparing to abandon his family to live in the woods. Again, we don't have, like, he's not like securing other things before he goes. So
yeah, the defense was able to say this was circumstantial. They argued that Vaughn's interest in survivalism was a hobby and not a motive for murder. They also pointed that there was no direct evidence linked to his wilderness aspirations to the crime. But perhaps the most heartbreaking point of this crime was testimony that came from Kimberly's family members. So the jurors were able to hear her family speak about her love that she had for her children and her commitment to being a good mom. Their emotional accounts stood in stark contrast to the defense claims that she was capable of such violence and that she was not herself anymore. You never know what is 100% true, but what her family is saying is complete opposite of what they were saying about her.
Absolutely. The jury also heard testimony from medical experts about the nature of her gunshot wound. The prosecution said that it was unlikely she could have inflicted this wound on herself, while the defense contended that she could. And again, you have experts on both sides speaking strongly that their testimony is the truth. There were weeks of testimony and arguments. Eventually, the case was handed over to the jury. Deliberations lasted less than an hour, which is wild considering the amount of detail that went into this, the forensics of the trajectories of the bullets, the blood stains, the mental health records, the search records. But there was also another big trial happening in Joliet, Illinois at the same time. And even before the verdict came back, Chris's attorneys were trying to get them to throw out the trial.
Yeah, and this is a case that we've actually covered, right? This is a
big one, yeah.
To say that these two trials took place in the same courthouse at the same time is fascinating.
Unbelievable.
In and of itself. But that was the trial of Drew Peterson. He was a former suburban Chicago police sergeant who was accused of murdering his third wife, Kathleen Savio. Both trials were unfolding in this courthouse just steps away from each other. And you could imagine the media circus that was taking place. And it really gripped the attention of not only this town and community, but the nation. This was big news. So the attorneys used these overlaps of these trials as a concern for his defense. They argued that the publicity and spectacle surrounding Peterson's case jeopardized Vaughn's ability to receive a fair trial. He specifically pointed out to the behavior of Peterson's legal team, whose antics outside the courthouse added to the frenzy, and he claimed unfairly influenced jurors in Vaughn's case. I don't know that I disagree with any of that, and you want your trial to be as fair as possible. And, I mean, shame on the clerks for scheduling these two high-profile trials in the same time in the same courthouse. That's a little weird.
It's super weird. We've never run into this before of two very high-profile cases being held at the same time in the same place. So I don't know what the other options are. The judge dismissed these concerns, ruling that the Peterson trial had zero impact on anything in Vaughn's proceedings. In fact, the judge noted that the notoriety of Peterson's case likely made the jury more credible in Vaughn's case, which I think is, a silly thing to say. Not that it's wrong, but I don't know that that's a good argument for the judge to claim. But Vaughn's attorneys filed this as the jury went away, but they quickly came back. And on September 20th, 2012, the jury returned their verdict. Christopher Vaughn was found guilty on all four counts of first-degree murder for his wife and each for his three children. The courtroom was silent as the verdict was read, and Kimberly's family expressed relief that justice had been served.
He was sentenced to four consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole, and he was transferred to Statesville Correctional Center in Illinois, where he remains to this day. But the case didn't end there. Over the years, he's continued to maintain his innocence. The defense team has filed appeals, arguing that the investigation was flawed and critical evidence was overlooked. Pretty typical for any case.
So, there's a big section here that I wrote as a reminder for myself, John. But where are you right now before I go into what I'm about to say? Do you think that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? Do you think there's a reasonable doubt? Do you think there was tunnel vision? Where's your mind?
Well, let me start that by answering something I've been thinking about. Like, the jury only deliberated for an hour.
One hour. I mean,
we are going to cover this entire case in just about an hour. So for them to take in all the evidence, critically think about it, and determine this guy's fate in 1 hour, it's almost alarming to me. It's almost like they went out and into deliberations like just already with their minds made up. So
yeah.
So was there any critical thinking? And I'll, you know, I'll be honest. I think that if I'm going to put money on this case, I think he probably murdered his wife and children. But is there room for reasonable doubt? Yes, because some experts believed that that the way the gun fell was possible. Some believe it wasn't. I wish that I could hear both of them say definitively one way or the other.
And why?
Yeah. I'm not going to even factor in his behavior during the interviews. I think that's irrelevant. I need to see the facts. So if I'm not mistaken, and you help me if I'm forgetting something, but bloodstains suggest that the story doesn't match with what he was telling us.
Right.
And there is some doubt that the way the gun would have fallen would have been consistent with her shooting herself and then dropping it.
Mm-hmm.
So those two pieces by themselves really cast a doubt in my mind that she killed her kids and then herself. But I cannot say with 100% certainty that I'm sure, because there was some debate even on those two things.
So I found out about this case when I listened to an investigative podcast, and we don't call podcasts out by name a lot, but this one was called Murder in Illinois. And this, in this podcast, Chris participated fully, and so did his family. So we get to hear from his family about what was going on behind the scenes, the reasons they thought that he was overlooked. And we don't ever hear from Kimberly's family. Now, to the credit of the people making this podcast, they tried, and Kimberly's family declined to participate, which is fine. But I listened to this entire show, and I thought, man, there's an innocent man behind bars, because I'd only heard the one side of it. And I was passionate about, we have to cover this to be another voice to get Chris Vaughn out of prison. But in my research, I was convinced otherwise. Yes, there are the pieces of doubt that you're mentioning are true, but I don't know that that's enough to say that it, I don't know if that's reasonable doubt that he didn't do it. Like, they're conflicting experts, yes, but we do have experts saying that the blood is consistent with the story, and the blood is, so who are you going to believe? And in my research, I chose to believe the prosecution's witnesses for the most part. So it was just a very big turn for me in looking at the actual court documentation and the actual reports out of what the police were saying and what happened at the time. Because when I listened to this one take on it, and again, I'm not faulting anything they did, but in this podcast, it comes across very one-sided, and I was ready to be an advocate, but really got a reality check when I looked at the facts.
Yeah, some things that, like, if I pretended to be the investigator, I was trying to think of what all do I need to take into consideration to make sure that I've covered my bases. I was thinking about, well, what side of her, what part of her body was shot, and does that match with what arm she uses primarily?
Right.
Was her fingerprints on the weapon in spots where they should have been? It's tough. I think that my gut is saying, yes, he killed his wife and his children. But I can't say, I think I'm like 90% there now.
Yeah.
So there is that 10% where I don't know for certain.
And do you know where you would figure that out for certain? In a longer deliberation, yeah. Going over all the facts and hearing both sides. But they didn't do that either. So was the investigation perfect? Absolutely not. Was the trial a little bit of a circus because of Drew Peterson and some other factors? Yes. I would be fine with Chris Vaughn getting a new trial, but I'm not ready to advocate for his innocence yet. So it's kind of where I'm at. Either way, I thought it was a phenomenal case to have conversations like this.
Yeah, this is a really good one. So thank you for doing the research on this one.
Guys, we are very thankful for all of your ongoing support, whether that's just downloading the episodes, writing reviews. We have merchandise. We're on Cameo. We're over on TikTok and Facebook and Instagram. Check us out. Join in the fun. We're trying to engage in a variety of ways now.
Yeah, we've got some great bonus content available for you. There's a chance that if everything works out, we will have already released some bonus content. So go make sure that you've subscribed to our podcast, because we do sometimes offer some bonus content on Mondays if we're able to interview someone. And I'm excited about the possibility. So hopefully you've already listened to that, or it's available now for you to listen to.
Yeah, hopefully it just happened. That's kind of where I'm at. Hopefully it works out. But very thankful for you guys. Been a phenomenal case. Write us reviews. Great way to leave us cases for recommendation. And we'll look for them over there.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.